question, healthcare organizations are struggling right now on several fronts. To support these organizations in this time of crisis, Congress passed the CARES Act 3 weeks ago. I'm Dr. Tom Villanueva, and on this episode of Modern Practice, we're looking at details from the CARES Act and how the law affects Medicare and provides relief to hospitals. My guest today is Shoshana Krillo, my Vizient colleague who lives and works in D.C. and knows the halls of power like the back of her hand and therefore has earned her place in heaven. Shoshana, share us a bit about your experience and your background, please.
Sure, happy to. I don't know about the heaven part, but I've been in Washington about 13 years now, so that I think that makes me officially a Washingtonian. I mean, Washington is your place where nobody's actually from here and people rarely stay, but apparently I am. So I came to DC, like I said, about 13 years ago to change the world, to work on Capitol Hill after an entirely different career before that. So I was fortunate enough to get a position working to advise a member of Congress in the House side. A couple of years later, I switched to the Senate side during the debate and passage over the Affordable Care Act and post-ACA world. Starting in about 2011, I've been in the private sector. I've been with Vizient now for about 4 years exactly. Prior to this, I was with the University of California Office of the President, helped representing the UC Health Care System in the Washington office for the Office of the President. So working on academic medical center hospital issues. So I transitioned that, like I said, to Vizient about 4 years ago. And people always ask, but I mean, I'm essentially the in-house lobbyist for Vizient, representing not just our company on matters that are important to our company, but for our members as well. And we have a small but mighty team here in DC.
Glad to have you here, Shoshana. So let's delve right into the questions. What exactly is the CARES Act?
So the CARES Act is the third thus far of Congress's effort to provide relief to the American people, mm-hmm. to businesses, and to providers, among others. It stands for the Coronavirus Aid, Relief, and Economic Security Act, CARES. And as I mentioned, it's the third relief package thus far that Congress has passed. It's a more than $2 trillion emergency supplemental funding package, the largest in history. So folks will, you know, sometimes remember back to the different so-called bailouts that Washington has done for different industries. Well, this is the largest, although we don't consider it a bailout. But it was, you know, passed in the Senate by a unanimous vote, passed in the House by a voice vote, went to the president, as you said, a few weeks ago. And it's essentially $2 trillion of relief to different segments of the population to help provide relief from all of the different impacts from COVID-19.
And from providers, I think you also are mentioning that not only large healthcare organizations, but also providers meeting clinicians, like physicians practices.
Oh, yeah. I mean, there's lots of different elements to this, frankly, that I'm still working through. But yes, I mean, some of the different funding streams, some of the different loan and grant opportunities that are available are not just for healthcare providers, even they're for other small businesses. But in the healthcare space, yes. In fact, I'm sure one of the larger pots that we'll get to is for, you know, quote unquote, eligible providers. But mm-hmm. that does include physicians' offices, other non-acute care settings.
Okay. And how does the law help support our members?
Like I said, a lot of different ways. So, I mean, let's start potentially with the biggest. Okay. That would be the $100 billion provider fund is what we're calling it, really. The thing that makes this unique is that these are grants. These are not loans. And so there are some additional provisions, like I mentioned in the law, that are specifically loans and or access to capital, et cetera. But this is a grant program. It is, like I said, for eligible providers. So that spans, you know, all types of providers. There wasn't, frankly, a lot in the legislation that dictated how that money should be spent. Mm-hmm. The biggest thing was just that it's this big pot of money and that it is available to providers. So we have already started to see it distributed. So I think it was just last week, about $30 billion of that $100 billion was distributed to members, Vizient members, as well as other healthcare providers that based on their 2019 Medicare fee-for-service claims. And so that was not prescribed in the law. That is something that HHS decided. It was, you know, a way for them to begin to distribute the money. There was some criticism about clearly basing that money on fee-for-service claims leaves out a pretty large number of our members and others. I mean, folks that have a higher proportion of Medicaid, uninsured, folks right. that the children's hospitals, for example, others that are obviously suffering primarily due to lack of elective procedures, but they don't have a lot of Medicaid, even the Medicare Advantage folks, or a lot of Medicare, I should say. And even the Medicare Advantage folks, they did not receive that as much in that recent pot of money. So the administrator of CMS said that the next pot of money will include, or hopefully include, some of those folks, but we don't really know how much that'll be. And frankly, we realize that $100 billion is going to be gone pretty quickly. You mentioned earlier, Tom, about it goes to clinicians. There was an interesting article this morning that I read that said that physicians' offices and some specialty physicians' offices were shocked to find that when they looked in their bank accounts last week, they had some money available, or money that was given to them via this fund. And I thought, well, goodness, I mean, whoever is representing you should have made it clear that you were going to get this money, because it really was just based on healthcare providers with Medicare fee-for-service claims. So yes, that goes to those smaller physician practices, larger practices, et cetera, really anybody at that point who had had Medicare fee-for-service patients. So it runs the gamut.
So I basically what we're hearing then is that it has a bigger impact, if you will, on those providers, whether it be organizations or physicians' practices that are seeing a large Medicare fee-for-service volume. CMS and the feds are realizing that, and they're trying to make provisions to correct that, or to cause organizations to become whole.
Well, let me clarify a couple things, because sure. I don't think it was not an unintended consequence. Oh. So the goal of the administration, as I understand it, was just that they needed to figure out a way to start distributing this money to providers, period. There wasn't anything in the law that said exactly how or exactly to whom. And in fact, the law characterizes it as something that providers may have to apply for. So for the first 2 weeks after this became law, we were getting lots of questions. And how do I apply for this money? How can I access this money? And frankly, the answer was, I just don't know. We're waiting on guidance out of HHS telling us how you can apply for this money. And then, you know, fast forward the end of that couple weeks, the administrator said, okay, no, you don't have to apply. We're just going to give it to you. But they needed to figure out a way that they could more easily distribute it. So my guess, and I have not had this confirmed, my guess is that it was just relatively easy for them to kind of make this calculation or create this formula based on Medicare fee-for-service claims. They worked with United Health Group with automatic direct deposits for different providers, although some will be getting or have received a paper check if they're not, you know, in that system. But I don't think it was lost on our policymakers or on HHS in particular that that was not going to cover all providers. I mean, they were acutely aware, no pun intended, of, you know, the fact that children's hospitals don't have Medicare patients, or that some safety net hospitals have a much higher proportion of Medicaid or uninsured. So it was purposeful. But right. I think the goal was always, okay, in the next round, we'll figure out how to dole that money out. Because my guess is it's from an operational perspective, it's just more difficult to calculate that formula with some of those other provider groups, since they're not in the fee-for-service claims database, frankly, I would assume. Then there was also some commentary, though, from HHS Secretary Azar that some of that $100 billion would be used to cover the cost of the uninsured, which is not something that hospitals, including Vizient, agree with. That was not the purpose of the fund as drafted, but we are expecting them to hold back some of that money to potentially reimburse for some costs for the uninsured. But I don't think it's the expectations that hospitals will be made whole. I think that's a risky assumption, because we have our hospitals are just losing so much money by basically being empty.
And absolutely.
This $100 billion is going to be gone quickly, which is why we are going to be advocating for more and why folks are already advocating for more. But I would not bet that people will be made whole by the end of this.
I appreciate that comment, where still our organizations, and specifically our members, have to look at still mitigating factors, because they will not be made whole through this legislative body, if you will, or act.
Right. For either through Congress or through HHS. I mean, it's just not a realistic assumption. And there are other eligible pots of money, if you will, in the CARES Act that we can talk about, you know, different loan programs through the Small Business Administration that certain providers may be eligible for. Mm-hmm. I don't have necessarily all of those details. I mean, the Small Business Administration, the SBA, a lot of that stuff is online. In fact, I just got an alert, though, frankly, just a minute ago that they had run out of funds for one of those loan programs, which is why we're expecting Congress to pass another bill quickly to beef that up some more, you know, but there are different loan programs that are also available to help providers of all different shapes and sizes, I should say, access different loan programs to help keep their staff on payroll. Some of those loans may end up being forgiven, but, you know, you never quite know. There's different types of emergency type of loans that are going to be available as well, mm-hmm. through the Small Business Administration. So lots of different types of loans, almost too many to count. We are in the process of trying to put that together for our members so that they can see where some of those access points are, but there's a lot.
Thanks for doing that. And also for our listeners, we do have a separate podcast with Jim Riley, who's a senior principal with SG2, and we do talk about how to get access to those loans and some of those grants as well. So please tune into that. So how exactly does this affect the Medicare Accelerated and Advanced Payment Program?
So that's a different program. So that was also, you know, that's a program that has existed prior to COVID, but the CARES Act did expand that program. They changed some of the repayment periods as well as, I believe, eligibility. So the accelerated advance or advance accelerated, depending on who you ask, program is available to a pretty broad group of Medicare Part A providers and B suppliers. So it's, you know, different types of folks can basically access their advanced, I mean, it not to answer the question with an obvious statement, but they can access advanced payments more quickly. So they'd have basically means they can, and they do have to apply for them, I should say. So this is not something that they should just expect to get a check in the mail. It basically allows them to access funds, even though they are not providing care right now, or not providing nearly as much care, of course, as they would normally. So there is an application process, and but it's, from what I'm hearing, pretty simple. In fact, the administration has said they've already doled out about $60 billion of advanced payments. So it's happening pretty quickly, which is great. To be eligible, providers had to have billed Medicare for claims within 180 days. They, you know, can't currently be in bankruptcy. They can't be in delinquent with any other Medicare overpayments. I mean, there are certain requirements in place, and we can, I'm sure, Tom, figure out a way to get that fact sheet to our members. I've sent it out to members already as well, but I know we have lots of different channels. And so it gives them, you know, depending on the type of provider, they have different repayment terms in terms of how long they have to repay that. And CMS will essentially start recouping those payments. I mean, we are aware of some of the challenges that folks might be facing in recouping or in repaying, I should say, or in CMS recouping some of those funds once providers start to kind of get up and running again. So we are also going to be doing outreach to try to help with some of the terms of those repayments, whether that includes lengthening the term of repayment. The interest rate, unfortunately, is quite high on any funds that are not recouped in the repayment period. It's 10.25% right now. So we've been working with the administration to try to get them to have more favorable interest rates, as well as possibly even forgive the loans in their entirety, frankly. So we will be working on that. But yeah, that's a program that has been, I think, perceived to be quite successful. I haven't heard from too many members on it quite yet, but I know that people are very interested in learning and how to apply for that.
Great. And again, I want to mention to everybody that we do have an additional podcast to let you kind of talks about how to get access to those loans and grants. Is this money only to be used to provide direct relief to hospitals, or can it be used for, say, covering the uninsured?
So both. And let's just talk about the Provider Relief Fund just to avoid any confusion. As I mentioned earlier, when Congress drafted the Provider Relief Fund, the intent was not to cover the uninsured. The intent was really very specifically to provide relief to hospitals for foregoing elective procedures, dealing with a wide variety of issues and kind of getting ready for a potential surge. It was not until Secretary Azar made a comment about 2 weeks ago now, I believe, saying that a portion of that funding would go towards covering the uninsured. So not great news. We have advocated that the administration should make it easier, I should say, for the uninsured to get healthcare coverage,
right.
Potentially via the exchanges and the Affordable Care Act, but for, I'm sure, a lot of different political reasons, as well as potential policy reasons that, you know, they are not necessarily choosing to, you know, open those up in any different fashion. But, you know, they have indicated, however, that a lot of folks that are uninsured are going to be eligible to enroll in the ACA just via special enrollment anyway. But that said, you know, we are not supportive of having to use these funds to cover the uninsured. We believe that that should be something the government just pays for versus hospitals having to use this relief fund for that. The other payments, though, as I mentioned, are direct, at least thus far. The intent is for them to be direct, meaning they're not supposed to flow through the states. There are different funds, you know, I think there was probably one in the CARES Act, but certainly before that, where oftentimes money does flow from HHS through the states, and then the states distribute those funds to hospitals. That is often the case in times of other emergencies, but it's usually a lot less money, frankly. That was not the intent of this provider fund. The provider fund was meant to be direct to hospitals to kind of cut out that middleman, if you will, to make sure that the money got to providers as quickly as possible.
So there are several ways that we can get coverage. We're getting more clarity. We understand there's other policies outside of care that the government is working for and trying to help our organization, specifically our members. So how can our members advocate for assistance?
Even outside of what's going on with COVID, I always, when I meet with members, encourage them to reach out to their elected representatives. I love kind of being the messenger, frankly, and working on behalf of our members, but it always makes me more effective if I can provide a hospital voice from a certain congressional district and flag that particular impact to that hospital's member of Congress or to that hospital's senator. Pick up the phone. You know, there are house.gov and senate.gov. You can figure out who your elected representative is. You can actually just call their office. Folks are working remotely like everybody else these days, but I'd like to think they have somebody answering the phones, as well as sending letters and emails to the different addresses on those members of Congress on their websites. And so just reach out and let them know what your challenges are. Let them know what you need. As I mentioned, right now, Congress is in the midst of considering a package 3.5 is what I have been calling it, because they have passed, you know, three fairly large stimulus bills, relief bills, and now they are underway working on number four, which could be quite large. But because of what I mentioned earlier with the Small Business Administration funds running out of money from CARES Act, or having already run out of money, I should say, as well as the Provider Relief Fund, Democrats and Republicans are potentially going to pass an interim package. So I call that 3.5, not nearly as big as, you know, what they have done in CARES or what they might do in CARES 2.0. But, you know, right now it's a good opportunity for folks to be reaching out to their members and letting them know what their issues are, where they can get some relief. And I always encourage people to be their own advocates.
So definitely reach out to your elective officials, because actually they are actively listening, and particularly to our healthcare organizations.
Yeah.
Are there any other benefits to the CARES Act that maybe our members should know about?
Yeah, absolutely. So, you know, in addition to the opportunities for loans and grants, there are lots of additional policies, actually, that the CARES Act put into place to help provide some relief to our hospital members. One of those, thankfully, is a delay of the pending Medicaid DSH cuts, the disproportionate share hospital cuts. Those were supposed to have gone into effect, I believe, next month. We've been working on delaying these Medicaid DSH cuts since 2014. So they've been delayed every year since they were set to go into effect, but they're pretty big, several billion dollars in cuts. These came out of the ACA based on the premise that hospitals would see a significant decrease in the number of uninsured, and therefore the DSH cut, or the DSH payments, I should say, would not be as necessary. However, we all know that ACA implementation didn't necessarily go as according to plan, and so Congress has been extending those Medicaid DSH cuts, but they were set to go into effect. So thankfully, in the CARES Act, they did delay those closed through December of this year, and they reduced the amount that would have gone into effect in that in this next fiscal year. We are going to be asking for a longer delay, frankly. I think that, you know, it'll be difficult to imagine the situation that our hospitals might still be in come December 1st of 2020. So, you know, we think a longer delay is going to be necessary, but at least we have that worry can be kind of taken out of the worry box, if you will, that you're not going to get some significant dish cut beginning this spring. Additionally, a big one, the Medicare sequester. So, you know, folks might not even remember, because the new normal has been this 2% Medicare sequestration, Medicare cut, what part of the sequestration, but that has been eliminated through December. But we will be asking for an additional delay of that as well. And then one other one I'll just flag is the COVID-19 20% DRG add-on. So I think CMS actually has been working pretty furiously to kind of figure out how hospitals can get paid or what could be those DRGs for COVID patients in particular. But Congress did increase the weighting factor of DRGs for inpatients with COVID by 20%. So that should be a nice little addition for those that are seeing a larger number of COVID-19 patients.
A 20% COVID add-on, which would definitely help out, particularly among our metropolitan organizations that have been significantly affected by this crisis. In addition to a delay in the dish cuts and the Medicare sequestration issues as well. So that's fantastic for our members to know.
Yeah. One more thing that just kind of came to mind, it might be kind of indirectly beneficial to our members, I should say, or maybe some of our non-acute care members, but there's been a significant effort both by Congress and the CARES Act, as well as follow-up by CMS, to increase those telehealth flexibilities. So, you know, really understanding that not all medicine necessarily needs to be practiced within the four walls of a hospital. And these are policies that hospitals have been pushing. So whether it's telehealth across state lines, and so really allowing physicians that work in the hospital setting to still be able to provide some amount of care to folks in different ways. And so, again, I'm not entirely sure how that will work relative specifically to the inpatient setting per se, but clearly we have hospitals that have a large footprint and, you know, different practices and outpatient clinics, et cetera. And I think that some of the telehealth flexibilities will be a welcome change.
Yeah. And I actually want to remind our listeners that we do have an outstanding podcast on telemedicine / virtual health and how to leverage that, not only right now during the COVID crisis as an opportunity to triage patients away from your emergency rooms that can be at risk, but more importantly, how to actually have revenue come in while you're going through this episode of lockdown. So thank you, Shoshana. And to our listeners, please join us for other Modern Practice podcasts on the Vizient Medical Leadership Channel. I'm Dr. Tom Villanueva. Thank you so much for listening.